Well, again, welcome to Riverside Calvary Chapel. We are excited to have this time to get into God's Word. And how many people were here last week when we kicked off Revelation 17 here and started to go through it? Raise your hand. How many were here last week? Okay. So, last week, as we saw here in verse 5, we looked at Babylon the Great, this false religious system that the Antichrist will use to gain ecclesiastical sanction for his rise to power. Now, in the Great Tribulation, this harlot that we refer to here, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, this harlot will be this spiritual system that is going to deceive the whole world during this time into worshiping Satan. So remember, the church at the beginning or prior to the tribulation period, the church has been raptured up. So all that's left is all this mishmash, this mix of what was seemingly religious, but was a false religion. And it's going to gain ground under the Antichrist and through this mother of harlots. And it's interesting that when Jesus taught about the parables of his kingdom, it showed to us how evil will seek to run parallel with the church and in the church age, and not just run parallel, but rather it's going to seek to infiltrate the church. This evil system, this religious system in a sense that is actually contrary to God, is going to seek to be invested in, poured in, and infiltrate the church. In fact, let's look at that real quickly. Matthew chapter 13. Keep your place in Revelation 17, but also flip over to Matthew chapter 13. We're going to read a little bit here about these parables, specifically this parable of the wheat and tares. So Matthew chapter 13. And we're going to pick it up in verse 24. Matthew 13, verse 24. And so we read there, another parable he put forth to them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field, but while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. Verse 26. But when the grain had sprouted and produced a crop, then the tares also appeared. So the servants of the owner came and said to him, sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares? He said to them, an enemy has done this. The servant said to him, do you want us then to go and gather them up? But he said, no, lest while you gather up the tares, you also uproot the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. And at the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, first, gather together the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn. So it's the counterfeit system of the enemy here that's at work. These tares that are growing up alongside the wheat, the good seed that the Lord planted, but the enemy also came in and planted these weeds. And that is this counterfeit system of the enemy. Understand, it may look good, but it is weeds. And just like when you encounter weeds in your garden, what do you need to do? You need to pluck them out, you see? Revelation 17 and 18, then, is the plucking out of this false system that the enemy has come and planted and infiltrated the church with. Read on in Matthew 13, verse 31 to 32, it says, another parable he put forth to them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of all the seeds, but when it is grown, it is greater than the herbs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and nest in its branches. Now, many people looked at that parable and thought, oh, speaking of the church, it's going to sprout and grow. It's going to be so prominent, so large, and the birds is going to have their come and nest. Oh, it's going to be beautiful. Isn't it going to be wonderful? Well, birds in the scriptures typically speak of an evil influence or presence. This is speaking of, again, the enemy coming and nesting within even the church, you see, looking to infiltrate the church. And the church, or I should say the false church, has indeed grown into a large presence. And it has become a place for the enemy to perch in and carry out his deceptive work. And that's going to be the case during this tribulation period that we're looking at here. And Jesus said in Matthew 18, verse 6 to 7, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe to the world because of offenses, for offenses must come. But woe to that man by whom the offense comes. this harlot of Babylon is the mother of harlots. She is the one that has brought this great offense. And what does Jesus say? Woe to the one by whom offense comes. Be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck. Hey, notice in Revelation 18, turn back there, Revelation. Look, jump over to Revelation 18, verse 21. It says, then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found anymore. So this is the judgment of Babylon. Just like Jesus says, woe to the one whom offense comes. Better if a millstone, put a millstone around his neck, throw him into the sea. That's exactly what's going to be happening to Babylon, this false system. And this harlot, as we see, is greatly deserving of all that God hands out to her. Now, last week we discussed some very interesting things regarding the roots of this Babylonian false religious system. If you weren't here with us last week, I encourage you to check it out online on our website, listen to that message, because we looked at some real interesting beginnings of this Babylonian system. It takes us all the way back to Genesis 11 and the Tower of Babel. Nimrod, you see, was this mighty hunter. We hear in Genesis chapter 10, I believe it is, Nimrod. And this false system really began with Nimrod and his family. Nimrod's wife, Semiramis, and her son Tammuz presented a counterfeit gospel that was introduced through them and this false religious system that began all the way back in Babel, which was Babylon. They introduced this idea that Tammuz was born miraculously, apart from Nimrod. He was killed later on and then came back to life 3 days later, you see. They celebrated with all these different pagan practices, right? We talked about how some of the pagan practices involved coloring eggs, cutting down evergreen trees, and propping them up to decorate them. Now, listen, I just want to say today, in case you went home last Sunday and announced to your kids, we're canceling Christmas this year. That's it, man. That message has freaked me out. Listen, let me just kind of put you at ease here, okay? I just want to put you at ease here, because when we do the things that we do at Christmas time, you know, putting up a Christmas tree and decorating the house, all that kind of a stuff, we're not following some pagan practice in the sense that that's not our agenda. That's not our motive. We're not sitting here saying, ooh, I hear they used to do this as a pagan practice. Let's copy that and mimic it. No, it has become a very kind of, you know, customary, traditional, cultural thing that we do that's disconnected from these pagan rituals, at least in our focus of them. That's not the intent, all right? I've gone back and forth on this. There's been, you know, seasons where we haven't put up a Christmas tree, and then, you know, well, we'll put it down in the basement, and then we'll see it, you know, and then, okay, it's back in the, you know, I've gone back and forth on this. And obviously, you need to follow your own convictions. You need to do what you feel is right, but we need to be careful that we are not also trying to impose something on other people. You know, in our church that we've had decorations up, and we've done things. So I just want to kind of put your mind at ease in case you went home and you've been sweating it out this week, you know, going, oh my goodness, what am I going to do this year? I don't have a problem with decorating our home and making the most of a dull winter season. And we're not doing it to celebrate, you know, the life of Tammuz or to worship a dead tree. If you are doing it out of some kind of pagan practice, then we're going to talk, all right? Then we got issues. Then we'll talk. But I know typically that's not the case for most homes here. So I want to put you at ease here in case you've been fighting through conviction or condemnation here. And that was the deal with the people in that day. They were doing these things and you know, bowing down, worshiping, following a pagan practice in doing so. But in all this, it simply goes to show how so much of what we see around us, and even in the name of religion, had its beginnings in Babylon. The picture of a mother and child, it had its roots in Babylon. The worship of relics is from Babylon. Priestly knowledge above the people, confessional, sprinkling of holy water, rosary beads, the sign of the cross, many believe was done to begin with as a T for Tammuz. It's from Babylon, you see. Everything that we do, we need to ask, is this from the Bible? Is this biblical? This practice, this thing that I'm following, is it biblical? See, don't follow something because the name of Jesus is attached to it, because many of these things gets done in the name of Jesus, but it's not biblical, you see. That is the standard for us, is it not? What does the Bible have to say about these things? That's the standard we follow. So, like I said last Sunday, Satan is simply tempted to mimic the things of God and to present a counterfeit. Some might say, you know, oh, the story of Jesus and a child. See, that's just a copy of stuff that had gone on way back in history. No, that's Satan's attempt to counterfeit what would be coming and cloud people from seeing and understanding the truth. It's a deceptive counterfeit, you see. Satan knew what was coming, and he seeked to present a counterfeit, deceptive alternative and to cloud people from receiving that truth. And so once the true church, again, is raptured up, this harlot of Babylon is going to attach itself to the institutional church, but it will incorporate the occult, astrology, humanism, paganism, as well as all the world religions into one eclectic doctrine. It'll be a universal religion that'll be taking shape. And its only creed is, believe anything but Jesus. That's going to be what they're standing for. Believe in anything but Jesus. See, it becomes tolerant of all ideas but true biblical Christianity. Hey, do we not see that at work today? Oh, we want to be a harmonious world. You can believe anything, but don't tell me that Jesus is the only way. Don't talk about Jesus. Jesus is an offense to people. They'll accept anything and everything except Jesus. This mindset we see has a strong view in the philosophy of the world today, and it's only going to increase into the tribulation. Look at what the Humanist Manifesto includes. The Humanist Manifesto, the second one, in September 2nd of 1973, listen to what was written up in that. We believe that traditional dogmatic or authoritarian religions that place revelation, God, ritual, or creed above human needs and experience do a disservice to the human species. Promises of immortal salvation or fear of eternal damnation are both illusory and harmful. They distract humans from present concerns, from self-actualization, and from rectifying social injustices. And thirdly, no deity will save us. We must save ourselves. This is the mindset that goes into the thinking of so many people in our world today. So we're fighting, you know, we're going upstream here. We're going against the current, ultimately. It's not going to be an easy ride, but we need to be those that are standing for the truth, because we understand that this false religious system is the stream in the current that many are following and just getting caught up in and flowing down in the world today without realizing that this is not true biblical Christianity. So, verse 6 of chapter 17, we finish with this verse, and it says, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, and when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. Understand that the false religious system is seeking to devour those that are standing for the truth. And we can expect no different in the world today. People are going to be against us. Don't think that when you stand for Christ, everybody's going to be all lovey-dovey for you now. Everybody's going to be all, oh, this is wonderful. I love you. Man, people are going to be opposed to you because you're standing for the truth. That they're saying, I don't want to be told what the truth is. I want truth to be my own truth, whatever I want it to be. And so this harlot, this false religious system, went after the true believers and the saints and devoured them. And it caused John to marvel. To marvel that this false religious system in cahoots with the Antichrist was working in this way and going against true believers. Look at verse 7. We'll pick it up here now. But the angel said to me, why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the 10 horns. Now, again, instead of us trying to, guess all these pictures and idioms that we're seeing here in our chapter, the angel is going to explain it for us. Now, first of all, take note that as we've been reading through all this, it would seem that this woman is carrying a lot of power as though she's in control. But notice what we read here. It's the beast that carries her. See, it's actually the beast who is the Antichrist, who was introduced to us in Revelation 13, that is using this religious system to advance his power. And that's going to be seen more clearly as we move along in this chapter. You know, sadly, throughout church history, as the church and state began to get intertwined, the two systems simply corrupted each other as compromise and greed for power crept in. It's two systems that are not going to gel ultimately. And yet, all through history, they've tried, and yet it's only caused corruption and compromise on both sides. So let's read on here. And this angel is going to explain these things for us, and we'll be able to see perfect sense of this. Let's read a few verses. Verse 8. The beast that you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. Here's the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen. One is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth and is of the seven and is going to perdition. So there you go. I mean, it's as clear as day, is it not? I mean, I'm so glad that the angel has gone and said, let me make sense of this for you, John. Here it is. So it's spelled out for us very clearly. So we can just move right on to verse 12 now. Pretty clear. Yeah. Well, so as you can see, this is really anything but clear. I'm like, you know, angel, you're like operating on like, you know, a university level. I'm still like in grade one here. Work with me a bit, all right? Help me out here a little bit, right? You know? So it sounds pretty confusing, as though even John himself can't quite, you know, make up his mind. The beast that was and is not, he's the eighth and he's of the seven. I mean, John, which one is it? Let's pick one already, right? But let's go through this and see what we can decipher for ourselves here. We read that the woman in verse 9 is sitting on seven mountains. Now, Rome has traditionally been called the city on seven hills. The city on seven hills. So many see this as a reference to the place of her power. In other words, there's a dominant Roman influence in this false religion. However, seven mountains may also refer to the successive world empires, since mountains are typically symbols of earthly kingdoms or empires. Notice what we read in verse 10 next here. It says in verse 10, there are also seven kings. So many see that then, in light of the seven mountains, not referring simply to seven kings, but rather to seven kingdoms. The seven kings represent the world ruling kingdoms that have or will be influential in God's plan for the ages. So there have been six kingdoms or world powers that have primarily existed through the history of the world thus far, and that the Bible has taken considerable interest in. Who can name what those six, or shout out some of those six world kingdoms? Just a little bit of help here. What's some of those? So we got Babylon. Okay, Greece. Medo-Persia. We've got what else? Rome, Greece, Babylon, Medo-Persia. First one being Egypt. And after Egypt came the Babylonians defeated them. Is Assyria. There you go. All right. You guys did it. Here we go. So I'll put up there for you guys. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. That's in order here. These are the six kingdoms that we've seen so far. Now notice here in verse 10, it goes on to say five have fallen. All right. Five have fallen and one is. So there's the five that have fallen, right? Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece. And then it goes on to say that five have fallen and one is. Rome. One is, it's Rome. Remember, John is writing this revelation while Rome is in power. It was the Roman government that has exiled John to the island of Patmos at this time while he's writing this letter for us, this book. So Rome is in control right now. And then it goes on to say, and the other has not yet come. That would be a reference to, I believe, along with many others, I believe it's speaking of the revived Roman Empire, which will be a 10-nation confederation during the time of the tribulation. This will be the Antichrist's opportunity for political power. And we're going to see how that 10-nation confederation fits in, because it's not just me throwing in some idea. It's shown to us here in God's Word. Daniel chapter 2, chapter 7, both talk about these ruling empires and their succession and eventual demise. Remember that image, that dream that Nebuchadnezzar had of the statue. Its head was of gold, and then it had chest and arms of silver, the belly and thighs of bronze, legs of iron, and its feet then were partly of iron and clay. And as Daniel interpreted that dream for him, he revealed that the head of gold was Babylon, the Persians were the chest and the arms, Greece was that belly and thighs of bronze, and Rome was the iron legs. Well, the last part then was a mixture of iron and clay. It had an element of Roman power in it, but it was made up also of other things. Now, understand that Rome has never been conquered as the other nations or kingdoms have. Rome has never been conquered. It just sort of fizzled out. And there's been no world ruling empire since. Many have come and tried, but nobody's taken that role. And so Rome was the last of those world empires. And yet there is coming one more, which will be made up of an element of Rome, because it's never been conquered, but it's going to have a mixture attached to it as well. Many have seen the European Union as a potential fulfillment of this revived Roman Empire. It's hard to say what exactly this will be. And, to kind of make a strong case for either thing, because what may be a strong possibility today becomes a thing of history tomorrow. And I've heard many pastors say, back in the 70s or the 80s, oh, this is what it's going to be. And then, number of years down the road, it's like, oh, that totally was way off. I didn't see this coming. And we do not see what is going to develop again. Some saw the European Economic Community as the most likely fulfillment of this a decade ago, but it was then absorbed into the EU and it ceased existence as a separate entity. So I'm not going to sit here and say, this is what I believe the revived Roman Empire is going to be. I believe it's going to be there, but I have no idea what it's going to be made up of or what government authority or power may be in existence today that might be a precursor to that. I don't know. But you know what? God's got it all worked out, and that's fine with me. Now, an interesting side note, the image on the back of one of the euro dollar coins is a woman riding a beast. So that's very interesting. So they seem themselves to know that they're playing a part in this whole role of chapter 17 of Revelation, chapter 17 and 18, as they're putting these kinds of images even on their currency. So, the beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth and is of the seven. That's there in verse 11. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth and is of the seven. It's really not getting any easier for us, is it? Right? We're like, I thought we're supposed to make sense of this, Brent, and yet you keep throwing these things out. That puts me right back. Two steps forward, three steps back. What is going on here? Well, listen, let's again work through this. Let's remember that the beast here now is the Antichrist. He's introduced for us in Revelation 13. In fact, can you turn over to Revelation 13 with me? Let's look at a few verses there. Revelation 13, we're going to read the first three verses. Revelation 13, starting in verse 1, then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded. And his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. Interesting. We see here that the beast was mortally wounded. Some believe he was assassinated and then miraculously came back to life. Either way, the world, it tells us in verse 3 there of chapter 13, will be astonished. They're going to marvel at this beast that was and is not, and yet is. You understand? The Antichrist was. He came on the scene. Then he was not. He was assassinated or mortally wounded or appeared to be mortally wounded. And then he came back as a greater force, which was then the eighth ruling empire. Verse 11, the beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth and is of the seven. So let's review this here again for you, okay? We understand there's eight kingdoms now being introduced. Eight kingdoms. I thought there were six, and then the seventh was a revived Roman Empire. How do we have eight now? Well, again, here's the first five. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persian, Greece, kingdoms 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Rome, at the time of John, is number 6. The Roman Empire will be revived in the first few years of the tribulation, making that now kingdom number 7. But then, see, the Antichrist is going to come on the scene. He's going to be a charismatic, popular leader promoting peace and harmony, and he's going to work with this present-day revived Roman Empire. He's not going to come on the scene, you know, with horns spitting out fire saying, I want to kill all of you, right? He's going to come on the scene like he's going to be attracted. People are going to be like, this is this leader that we've been waiting for. Oh, he's going to bring about harmony and peace and unity now in the world. This is the guy that we've been waiting for. So he's going to step into this position now and say, yeah, I've got you guys here, right? And he's going to come and work along with this revived Roman Empire. But at the halfway point of the tribulation, what does the Antichrist do? He goes into the temple, seeking to be God, to be worshipped as God. And it's when, at that point, he ceases to be what he was for those first 3.5 years. And now he just comes in a rage, seeking full control. There's no pretense any longer of sharing any power with this revived Roman Empire or with working with other leaders. He's it. He's the show now, you see. And technically, at this time, it's no longer just a revived Roman Empire. It becomes the empire of the Antichrist as he steps in now and says, this is now mine. And it becomes the Antichrist kingdom, number 8 in this list. So the Antichrist then was of the 7, but comes to supreme power and is then the 8th kingdom. Is this starting to kind of put it together for you a little bit? Anybody? Just entertain me. Nod your head up and down. All right. If anything, just to wake yourselves up. Whatever it takes. But so that's what we're seeing here now as we go through this. We're really looking at going back in history at these world empires. And then again, what is to come, you see. Let's look on verse 12. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. Remember in chapter 13, we saw the Antichrist come with 10 horns. Well, the 10 horns, as it tells us in verse 12, are 10 kings. They haven't received a kingdom as yet. They're not in any kind of reigning position, but they're going to give their authority now to the Antichrist, to the beast. So these 10 kings are these 10 nations that I talked about that are going to form this 10-nation confederation, an alliance with the Antichrist, and form this revived Roman Empire, a European confederation, or this revived Roman Empire. It's Nebuchadnezzar's dream that we saw in Daniel 2 and 7, where it was, you know, the feet made of a mix of iron and clay, the 10 toes, you see, are these 10 parts of this revived Roman Empire. Notice again, we see a reference to time. It says they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. In verse 10, we read that when the beast comes, he must continue a short time. Do you see that there in verse 10? He must continue a short time. And here they receive authority for 1 hour. In other words, we're seeing the brevity of their power and work as God is the one in control. He's the one that's orchestrating this and is in control of all this. This is not God sitting back, taking his hand off the wheel, saying, all right, you guys just go ahead and do your thing. He's like, okay, I'm going to give you a short time to go about your business, but understand, I'm the one that's heading all this up here. Aren't you so thankful for that? Guys, I pray that that brings great hope to you today, that though we live in a world of an uncertain future to a degree, we can place all of our concerns into the hands of the one who holds the future and is controlling the future. And with that, there is great comfort and peace that it brings us to know that, God, I may not have it all figured out. I may not know exactly what is going to be happening tomorrow. But Lord, I'm just simply placing my life in your hands because you're the one in control anyways. And that's a great comfort for us. Isn't that good? So we have to remind ourselves of these things. When we see things taking shape around us, that even look evil and sinister, and we're seeing that all around us. And we wonder, oh my goodness, how are we going to make it? Well, listen, we got God on our side. God is able, as we sang here today. He is in control of all these things and allowing it to happen, but for a short time. Ultimately, these 10 kings will hand over full control then to the Antichrist. And this is what Satan has dreamt of, isn't it? Is to have power and the praise of men. This is what Satan has been waiting for. Give me control. Give me power. Give me the praise of men. That's what he's been desiring, and that's what's going to happen in this end time scenario. We'll look at verse 13. I'll read there. These are of one mind. They will give their power and authority to the beast, as we talked about. And then these will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called chosen and faithful. So again, this has been the plan of Satan from the beginning. His desire has been to defeat the one who will ultimately crush him. He's heard that report in Genesis chapter 3. We talked about that last week. He's heard the report that out of the woman's seed will come one that will crush his head. And so his goal has been to destroy that seed. Ultimately to destroy Jesus and his people. Listen, if you're living for Jesus, you can bet that you've got a big target on your back in the enemy's eyes. Understand that you're walking around in this world with a big target on your back, and the enemy is right there trying to throw those fiery darts your way and take you down. But take heart, because what do we read here? That Jesus is Lord of lords, and he's King of kings, and nothing can come against him because he's already overcome the world. John 16, verse 33, in the world you will have tribulation. Jesus spells it out for us. Hey, it's not going to be easy in this world because the world is against you. But he says, be of good cheer. I've overcome the world. Take that to heart, my friends, today. You're not promised an easy ride in this world. Jesus tells us that. You're going to have tribulation. But be of good cheer. Why? Because I've overcome the world. Just read the end of the book and you will see how victorious we are. Hang on, my friends. Hold on to Jesus. Be in Jesus every day. Put on the armor of God. Put on Jesus Christ every day. That's our protection. That's our help. That's our hope here that we have. And notice what we see here. We're with them. And the enemy, it says, the Lamb will overcome them, for he's Lord, Lords, King, Kings, and those who are with him are called chosen and faithful. That's us, guys. We're with him. We're the chosen and faithful. We're all accounted for in that day, you see. And we're called chosen and faithful. How are we chosen? Not by merit, right? This isn't a lineup and pick the team sort of a thing, right? You ever been in those positions? I hate that when I was young because I was always the shortest kid in the class and nobody wants to take the short kid on the team. You line up, you're like, okay, let's take we'll take him. All right, yeah, you go ahead. You can come on our team, I guess. You know, we hate those things. But with Jesus, this is not based on merit. This is not based on stature. This is not based on, well, let's see, are you going to help our cause? How are you in this situation here? You know, how good are you going to be? Are you going to really? No, it's like this is not based on our merit. This is based on his grace and our willingness to see our need for it. I love that. If we remain in that place of realizing our need for his salvation, then you are the faithful. That's what it is. Staying faithful. This is not staying faithful to do this, staying faithful to do that, staying faithful to have this or be there or do this. It's being faithful to say, Jesus, I am in daily need of you just for my salvation. And those that remain in that place to say, every day, Jesus, I need you. Because I know that I can't go to heaven or I'm not saved by what I do. But it's because of what you've done for me. Those that stay in that place are faithful. Aren't you glad for that? And he is interceding for us. He is helping us. And he will present us in that day, as Jude says, as faultless. We will be presented faithful as we keep our eyes on him and keep trusting in him. Well, verse 15, then he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And the 10 horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. Now, we talked about the waters last week where this harlot sits. Again, speaks of her widespread influence now upon the whole earth, because it speaks of peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. It's a widespread influence that this false religious system has. And when the Antichrist has his way, he has no need for this religious entity. He's going to toss her aside, making it clear that he was just hypocritically using her to advance his purpose. She's going to be bucked off the bull, in a sense, and trampled on. You know, throughout history, church and state have attempted to work together, as I've said, but it's never been a happy union. Too often, people have been pushed aside, beaten up, destroyed because of it. And like this harlot, many people have attempted to ride the bull of satanic compromise. And they've maybe enjoyed a season like this harlot where it seemed like things were just going their way, like they were getting away in their sin. Maybe some of you have been in that position formerly in your life where you thought, oh, things are going well. I'm getting along in my sin. I'm getting away with my sin. But you understand, eventually we will be burned and devoured by the very sin that we thought we were controlling. Because the Bible says the wages of sin is death, and you reap what you sow. If you are going to play with the devil, you better not expect loyalty from him. You certainly cannot expect mercy from him, because his only intent is to kill and destroy. The Bible makes that very clear to us. If you are thinking today that I'm all right, I'm doing okay, I'm not too deep into what I'm involved in, that's exactly what the enemy wants you to think. The enemy wants you to think that this is okay, that this is harmless, that you're going to be just fine. But his intent is to eventually buck you off that bull and to trample you and destroy you, just like he's doing with this religious entity here, with this false religious system. You cannot expect the devil to play fair, guys. Don't even go there. Don't even entertain sin one bit, because it will destroy. Look at verse 17 here. For God has put it into their hearts to fulfill his purpose, to be of one mind and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. Again, isn't it good to know that God is in control? God is the one that's put it into their hearts to fulfill his purpose. I love that, because all these guys are sitting here thinking, all right, we're finally getting what we have always wanted. And God's just sitting here from heaven's perspective going, oh man, if you only saw what I can see, because you're fulfilling my purpose. Everything that I want to see accomplished is getting done, and your plans are ultimately going to fail. But they don't see that. It's God's purpose that is being done. He's in control. Even in times, guys, of chaos or bleakness, God is still ordering everything along according to his perfect will. All things, as Romans 8:20 tells us, work together for the good to those that love God and are the called according to his purpose. Proverbs 21 verse 1 says, the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. Like the rivers of water, he turns it wherever he wishes. Kings are appointed by the Lord, and he's the one that's going to use them for his purposes. It's not the other way around. Satan may think he's getting away with it, but he himself is going to realize that he too is getting burned. Understand here, guys. Let me back up a little bit. Back to verse 8. Look at what we read there. The beast that you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and then go to perdition. I think we read that again at the end of verse 11. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth and is of the seven and is going to perdition. Just remind yourselves of that. Satan's eventual outcome is going to be in the lake of fire. That is this place of perdition. Satan doesn't dwell in hell. The lake of fire, as we're going to read coming up in Revelation, is the place that we typically refer to as hell. But understand that hell right now is not occupied by anybody. Nobody is in hell right now. When people die apart from trust and faith in Jesus Christ, they go to this place of Hades. This holding tank, in a sense. It's not a comfortable place, as Luke chapter 15 or 16. I always get those mixed up. As Luke tells us there, with Lazarus and the rich man, it's not a place of comfort. It's a place that's divided, compartmentalized. Abraham's bosom, and then this place called Hades, place of torment, you see. Abraham's bosom, I believe, emptied out when Jesus resurrected again from the grave and brought all those saints, and that's who they were in Abraham's bosom, those that have believed in God apart from the promise being realized, the promise of Jesus Christ, but they were taken to heaven. But the place of Hades still is occupied by all those that die apart from faith in Jesus Christ. Satan does not have his home in hell. He's in this also temporary place, in this bottomless pit. He's able to have access to it, and he comes out, but he's eventually going to be sent into the lake of fire. And we're going to get to that in Revelation here coming up. He's going to be cast in the lake of fire. The Antichrist will, the false prophet will, and the devil, this unholy trinity, is going to be placed in the lake of fire where they will be in torment forever and ever. They're not going to be at home. They're not sitting there going, all right, now I'll just have my minions to serve me in hell. No, they're going to be in torment. And at the end of the millennium, at the great white throne judgment, what does it tell us? That Hades and all the death gave up their dead, and they were placed in their final judgment, and then placed in the lake of fire. So here's Satan's outcome. Satan may think that he's getting along in things, but he himself too is going to have his final outcome as God takes him and places him in the lake of fire. Verse 18, and the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Again, a reference to Rome, the world power at the time of John writing this. Now, many people like to tie in the whole idea of Roman Catholicism as being the false church or this false religious system, but it's going to be a whole lot bigger than just the Roman Catholic Church. That will have a part in it, no doubt. And a big part, I'm sure, but it's going to be made up of a variety of backgrounds and beliefs. It's going to be all encompassing of different ideologies, different faiths, different practices. That's what this false religious system is going to do. This ecumenical movement is making a strong push today. Many churches even today are looking to embrace other ideas and faiths to make the gospel seem more palatable. But yet, Jesus says that narrow is the way. Broad is the way that leads to destruction. Narrow is the way and few find it. Oh, we want to get that truth out, but we can't seek to make the truth a broad thing and say it's whatever you want it to be. Truth is very narrow, generally, is it not? 2 + 2 = 4. It's a true statement. Somebody comes to me and says, well, I don't like that. I don't like that equation. I want it to be 5, maybe 6. How about 7? That's what people are doing with the things of God. I don't want it to be that. Truth is not absolute, they'll say. Truth is whatever you want to be, yet we don't follow that same logic in all the other things that we do. And we can't sit here and try to broaden truth, because broad is the way that leads to destruction. We need to give the truth. We need to share the truth. We need to share the good news with people, no doubt about it. Sadly, there are few that find it, Jesus says. But this ecumenical movement is making a strong push today. Now, in addressing a prayer gathering of Christians, Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, and others, Pope John Paul II, this is going back a few years, told participants that their efforts were unleashing profound spiritual energies in the world and bringing about a new climate of peace. The Pope pledged that the Catholic Church intends to share in and promote such ecumenical and interreligious cooperation. The Catholic Review commented on this and said, the unity of religion promoted by the Holy Father, Pope John Paul II, and approved by His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, is not a goal to be achieved immediately, but a day may come when the love and compassion with both Buddha and Christ, preached so eloquently, will unite the world in a common effort to save humanity from senseless destruction and lead toward the light in which we all believe. The light in which we all believe, really. There's only one light, the light of the world. Satan masquerades himself as an angel of light. Sadly, there are many following that light. It is not a universal light. There is one light, the light of the world. It's Jesus Christ. And that is the way to heaven, the way to eternal life, the way to forgiveness of sin. It is found in Jesus alone. Now, interestingly, the present Pope Francis has renewed the same ecumenical outreach to communities of other faiths. He is, of course, as many of you know, he is preparing for his U.S. tour in just a week or two, where he's going to be addressing the UN and lending his support to Agenda 2030. How many people have heard of Agenda 2030? If you're familiar with Agenda 21, which was introduced a number of years back, this agenda is Agenda 21 on steroids, they say. Agenda 2030 is about global sustainability. It addresses climate change, poverty, gender equality, to name a few points. And it is all about bringing about a global balance. To do that, it's going to require a one world government, one world religion, one world economy. These are all things that Revelation is telling us is coming. Their catchphrase, of course, is no one left behind. Everything that they're promoting sounds good on paper. Oh, it's wonderful. But the motive, the agenda behind it all is, again, a government control of all people to bring about a sustainable planet and to bring about a sustainable harmony and unity, which government is going to have a big part in. Their catchphrase, no one left behind. The problem is many of them will have been left behind because they're placing their trust in the wrong source. It's not found in religion or government that we're going to find a global peace here. It's found in Jesus alone. He's the source that we need to look to for all that man needs. It's found in him. These guys are going about it the wrong way. And the Pope is tying himself in and uniting himself to the UN and the world government parties. And it's simply what we see happening in Revelation 17. Oh, I'm not saying that, you know, the Pope is this harlot or that he's the false prophet. Some will say, oh, this is it, man. This is the guy. We're walking into, you know, these very, very last days. Some will say that. We don't know exactly. But understand what is already at work in the world today and how we need to be on guard and saying, I simply want to follow Jesus and live for him. And I want to get the good news out to people so that they can be, as I've been saying, spared from all these things that we're addressing in Revelation 17. Amen? Amen. All right. So here's what we're going to do right now, guys. We're going to take a couple minutes. Worship team, come on up. And I've been asking you guys to be praying for people, to be taking the gospel out. I want you guys right now, just in your own time, to bring somebody to mind, somebody that you know that doesn't know Jesus Christ, whether it be a neighbor, a family member, person at work, a friend that you have that doesn't know Jesus. Take some time right now and pray for them. Pray for the Lord to give you opportunity to continue to share the good news with them, to find time to invite them to church where they can hear the gospel again. You may not be comfortable sharing the gospel with them. I hope you are. But invite them to church, because at church they're going to have an opportunity to hear the gospel presented to them. And you're going to hear how to present the gospel so that you can learn how to do it too. But invite these people to church. Get the gospel to them. So right now, find somebody, whether it's one, two, three people, bring them to mind and just intercede right now for them before the Lord. And then we're going to close in a song and prayer together. Okay? Go ahead.